Well, beloved listeners, China's exhilarating expansion into the South China Sea has been a global flashpoint since 2012, I guess, when the country went head-to-head with the Philippines in that confrontation over the Scarborough Shoal fishing reef. More of that later. As China extends its reach, less powerful states look to the US for diplomatic mediation, for an American security umbrella that stretches across the Asia Pacific, nicknamed the American Lake. My next guest suggests that tensions over the disputed territories extend well into the previous century, and that China's advances are rooted in its understanding of its 5,000 years of history. Humphrey Hawksley is a journalist and author who's been a foreign correspondent for the BBC since the early 1980s. Humphrey's most recent book is Asian Waters. Humphrey, welcome to our Little Wireless program.
Hello, it's good to be with you.
Humphrey, why is the South China Sea so bloody significant?
Well, that's a very good question. It rests on the southern coastlines of China, and it's got, I think, 50% of the world's trade goes backwards and forwards from there in the course of a year. And so it's vital globally, and it's vital to China. If you talk to any Chinese student, any family, anywhere in China, deeply embedded in them is this idea of what they call the century of humiliation. And that was when in 1839, British gunboats pounded their way to shore near Guangzhou. And because they had better technology and better guns and better discipline, they won. They were trying to sell opium from India into China. And China banned narcotics at the time, but the British won. They then saw that as the beginning of this century of humiliation, which didn't end until 1949 when Mao Zedong and the Communist Party came to power. And one of their sort of doctrines has come is that we will never become weak again. We will never be slaves again. We will never let the Western powers or any other power dominate China again. So what they've done by building, by militarizing essentially the South China Sea, and over the, since 2012 that you mentioned, they have built seven military bases down what place known as the Spratly Islands and modernized the Paracel Islands. And they are sort of like a strait. They're two flanks of the South China Sea. When the ships go through the Malacca Strait and they head up there towards Japan and Korea, China itself, the Philippines and Taiwan, they are now basically going through the sort of military positions of China, like going through a strait. And the United States can send carrier groups out there and Australia can send its navy out there and everything, but there's nothing better than having a missile and an air base sort of sitting in the water there that can control it. And that is the big problem that the world has at the moment, because these bases have been called illegal under international law. And in 2016, a court ruled that they were illegal. So if we, and when I say we, the West, the whatever you want to call us, allow it to happen in the South China Sea, what are the next 10, 20, 30 years when China expands all over the world, when Russia wants to do this, when Iran wants to do this, indeed, when Australia or Britain wants to do something that doesn't meet it, we can always cite, well, they got away with it in the South China Sea, so we can do what we want.
Humphrey, China did this in plain sight. You know, they were able to build these bases without significant opposition from the US or other Asian nations.
Yes, and actually, very interestingly, it was Australia that first flagged it up way back in 1959. And the Australian Joint Intelligence Committee had a memo, and it said that if in the longer term the communist Chinese were to develop these islands militarily, it's talking about these very same places, they could make a nuisance out of themselves on the international shipping and air routes on the pretext of infringements of territorial waters, and might even shoot down an aircraft occasionally. That note went to Washington and London at the time, wanting either the British or the Americans to help take over the islands and control them. but nothing happened. You had Suez, you had the Vietnam War happening, you had the Korean War, you had all these other things going on that were more important. And then, as you say, 2012, there was the thing in Scarborough Shoal, and the court ruling that was coming out, that started in 2013. And in that past 5 or 6 years, these bases have been built, and they did it in such a clever way that nobody said, well, that's a red line that's been crossed. We can't let them get away with that. And suddenly you found, well, there was a runway there, and there was a port there, and then next thing, missiles were in there, and then planes were in there. But it was just so incremental and so slow.
Well, like in your book, you talk about satellite images, particularly of the Subo Reef, as evidence of the pace at which the bases were developed. Let's look down at the scene via an imaginary satellite image. What would it show?
Well, if you look down now, you will see what might look out in a tourist brochure, a sort of lagoon with different shades of blue water there, circular mostly. But you would see rebuilt land there, so you would see a runway that might take up pretty much all of it. Then you would see various buildings, and as you go closer on, you would see buildings that could be identified as an aircraft hangar, as a control tower, as an air control tower, and ones that the military defense experts can identify as mobile missile bases and that sort of thing, and then ports for it to go on. And the seven bases in the South China Sea, in the Spratly Islands that have been built, they're of different sizes. Some are bigger, some are smaller. But essentially, they are all mini military bases where you can land planes, you can dock ships, you can keep your munitions.
Humphrey, we've done a few programs in recent years on the subject, but there's one entirely new phrase that I learned from you, and that's the 9-dash line. Tell us about its significance.
The 9-dash line is what the Chinese claim is their territory. And locally in Asia, they call it the cow's tongue. So if you imagine the contours of Southeast Asia running down Vietnam, coast down to Thailand, Singapore, and then looping back up through the Philippines and there, that's like a sort of a tongue hanging out of a cow's mouth. And inside that 9-dash line is what they say is their, China says is its territorial water. That's about 90% of the South China Sea. Interestingly, they also haven't actually announced the coordinates. So I was in an island off Vietnam where the fishermen go and fish in disputed waters there and often get water cannoned off by the Chinese. And he said, well, they could come and take us at any time because their 9-dash line could actually go through this island. And I don't know, you mentioned at the beginning that they want, you know, that these countries want the U.S. to help, that they know that China's there, they know China's strong, they know China needs it for, they need China for its economy. So they're in a quandary. And when you talk to these fishermen, they sort of say, well, you know, we fished here for generations. And now if we go there, we come up against the Chinese Coast Guard.
Tell us the water cannon story that begins the book with the Filipino fisherman.
Yeah, well, that was the Scarborough Shoal that you mentioned at the beginning, Philip. And that is there's a small fishing village. You imagine a sort of small, very local community there, and they fished for generations around Scarborough Shoal, which is about 100 miles off the coast of the Philippines, and they go backwards and forwards and do that. And one guy that I went called Yurik Olsen, he was up fishing there, and the Chinese came in and they water cannoned him off his boat. And it's not a very sophisticated boat. These things, they look like something out of a sort of Tudor medieval fun fair or something. And water cannoned off the boat, he climbed back on, they water cannoned him off again. And then guys came around in a high-speed boat with arms telling him to go away and not come back. So he went away and he couldn't come back to that village, to the fishing. But back in his village, he and the other fishermen couldn't earn a living. He tried to be a sea clear driver. He tried to work in a shop. But this was a big man used to the weather and the waves and the fishing. And they couldn't support their families. So the wives had to take contracts as domestic workers in Saudi Arabia. And if you imagine how that strips the esteem and the soul out of a village, out of a small community. And then Duterte, President Duterte of the Philippines, went and cut a deal with the Chinese.
That was when he was knocked back by Washington. He asked them to
get
him some assistance, and they gracefully declined.
Well, they actually said, we're not going to go to war over a fishing reef. There's an interesting nuance to that, because the military treaty with the Philippines meant that the Chinese would have had to have attacked or gone into confrontation with a Philippine military vessel, and only the Philippine Coast Guards was there, which is a civilian vessel, so they couldn't activate that treaty.
So Duterte then cuts a deal.
He cuts the deal, and the deal was that they could go back and fish there, but they fish under the vigil of the Chinese Coast Guard. So China owns and controls, doesn't own, China controls that reef. So this is if you take that sort of as a microcosm of what China is doing throughout Southeast Asia, indeed throughout much of the world, is that they use the term punishment and reward. So they'll go in and they'll take something away and then they'll give it back. But they've got the control of it.
This is Alan L. on RN, on your digital radio and online. And our guest is BBC foreign correspondent Humphrey Hawksley. And Humphrey's latest is entitled Asian Waters. Now, during this period, Obama was backing off. He didn't want to escalate tensions with China, but that's clearly not the current feeling. And late last week, US Vice President Pence has really been escalating Washington's pressure campaign against Beijing by criticizing these tactics in the South China Sea. Is this a major, major, major change of approach?
I think it is. I think it's. I think it's almost the extent of them. If you remember Reagan and saying pull down the wall, I think Pence is saying Xi Jinping, President Xi Jinping, tear down those islands. His speech last week, which has been sort of criticized or praised for starting a new Cold War, said blatantly, "We will not be intimidated. We will not stand down." From the islands. And then he went on with a litany of elements that China had done wrong. It runs an unparalleled surveillance state. It's repressing religion. It's squeezing Taiwan, which he said that the Chinese people should follow Taiwan and embrace democracy like them. The trade deal that struck across the other side of the world with Mexico and Canada included a phrase that actually said that they could veto each other's deals with non-market economies, which is seen as a sort of as an arrow going to the heart of China, saying, you know, if you want to trade with us, you need to get your act together. I think what China's been feeling, Philip, in the past couple of months, maybe less, is a really ratcheting up against its expansion, against its really much heralded the Belt and Road Initiative and that sort of thing that captured global imagination a year ago, is now sort of running into the buffers a bit.
Let's dwell on the Pence speech a little. Perhaps it's picking up the momentum, which seemed to be successful, of Trump's bluster against North Korea. And he sought to build on Trump's speech at the UN last week, in which he alleged that China was trying to interfere in US elections. Pence has also said in this recent outburst that China has masterminded wholesale theft of American technology. So it's not simply the islands he's discussing.
No, I think the islands is the military element. It's where you've got the US and Chinese militaries coming face to face. And I think away from all that, you've got the trade element, you have got the stealing of technology, you've got the entry to the China market, you've got the whole democracy thing, you've got the soft power where these Confucian institutes are now all around the world, really sort of teaching China's model. And then you've got this sort of Belt and Road Initiative, which has been going on for some decades now, that has sort of been wrapped up last year with a big summit, which is this authoritarian way of development, of building infrastructure, bridges, roads, airports, that sort of thing, getting other countries into debt. And I think this is Trump and Pence laying down a marker of saying, right, you've got to stop. Otherwise, you know, and they bring this idea of democracy out again. So you've got the democracy and the dictatorship thing. You have got this Cold War element swaying out. One of the more interesting elements there is, why did Pence make the speech? He doesn't have a China record at all. What I've been hearing in Washington circles, and that is that this is the one guy that Trump can't sack. So the Chinese will know that whatever Pence says, I mean, is said, and he's in office at least for another 2 to 3 years or possibly longer.
Will China blink? Will it give ground? That's probably a totally inappropriate word.
Well, there's two. One is that you have this face issue in China, so, you know, will it blink? I think it's going to have to. There's a lot of very pragmatic, very, very bright people in Beijing that have got it this far. It's taken over, or its influence in the world has spread without a shot being fired in anger at the moment, which is a lot better than the British or the Americans or the Spanish or the Portuguese managed. I think that Xi Jinping is getting a lot of opposition within the government of saying, hold back. You know, we cannot afford to take on the US at the moment. Because if we do, our economy is going to take a hit. And if our economy takes a hit, as it is in the trade war, we risk social unrest. And that is the Communist Party dream being threatened. And all of this debate is going on is how far to push, how far to push back. And Trump and Pence in this speech have laid down a marker. And quite how it unfolds is difficult to say. But the South China Sea in the islands is a place where there could be a military miscalculation that could ramp up the ante very quickly.
You write that China is particularly attentive to the 1823 Munro Doctrine, the central foreign policy of the fifth president. Why is that so important to China?
I think it's because it is doing in the South China Sea what the US did with the Munro Doctrine in the early 19th century in the Caribbean and Latin America. So essentially what the US did there was say that no power can be more powerful than the United States in our backyard, as the phrase was. And this was a message to the colonial powers that were being expelled and pushed out, not to go back and keep interfering in it. The Munro Doctrine, which you know, what it's doing in the South China Sea is a very similar thing. So this is our backyard. Southeast Asia or Asia is our patch, and the U.S. is not geographically located in there. So at some stage, it will want to be the big power there, and for the U.S. to move out. Interestingly, if we look at India. India has not implemented a Munro Doctrine, and therefore in the places that are its backyard, like Sri Lanka and Nepal and Bangladesh, China is taking a bigger role. It's got much more influence than it had, say, 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, because India hasn't implemented this backyard Munro Doctrine-style policy.
You linked this current tension to the Opium Wars. Let's go back even further, because you suggest a connection between China's regional foreign policy and the great war strategists of ancient Chinese history, like Sun Tzu. Explain the connection.
The connection is that the strategists of China, which are still sort of at the heart of what they are planning to do. But the whole element of that is to trade and to grow your influence and to exert your power without violence, and bring people into this mandate of heaven that comes under. So up until the mid 18th century, China was a global economy, and then its center of humiliation happened, and it collapsed down, and now it's trying to bring itself up again. Before that, it had more sophisticated warships. It had more sophisticated navigation techniques than we had in Europe. And Marco Polo, among others, reported seeing these huge sort of Chinese ships going around in the Indian Ocean. And then it sort of stopped and said, no, we will, a bit like an isolationist policy, it said, no, we will close in on that and we will not go and explore the world anymore. And that was that sort of downward path, as it were. And now, of course, you find that it's spending more on its navy, and it's spending more on its, shipping, and it's the Chinese ships that are the COSCO, the Chinese cargo company, is pioneering the shipping routes through the Arctic, for example. So that is a reversal of that policy.
Let us hope that the current regime remembers the advice of that 5th century BC general, quote, "The supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting." That was BBC correspondent Humphrey Hawksley. Good on you, Humphrey. His latest is called Asian Waters, and it's published by Bloomsbury.